Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
Hello there, I'm Matt Everett, and I recorded this episode of The First Time with Chris Cornell in 2013. As you may know, Chris sadly died in 2017. He took his own life having suffered with depression for many years. I found him to be charming, articulate, passionate, and funny, and I hope this programme provides a fitting tribute. Welcome to The First Time on Six Music with me, Matt Everett. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Today's guest emerged from the Seattle music scene and with his band, Soundgarden, changed the face of alternative rock music. Formed in the mid-80s, Soundgarden stood apart from a lot of the grunge bands that found fame in the 90s. Rather than following in the garage noise of the Stooges or punk rock, Soundgarden channel Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin. They've got heavy riffs, complex song structures, literate lyrics, and seriously intense vocals. As you heard in that song, Rusty Cage, from 1991's album Bad Motorfinger, Soundgarden were heavy, and Soundgarden still are heavy. They got blown apart amidst stories of substance abuse and infighting in 97, but they reunited in 2010 for a tour, and last year released a strong comeback album called King Animal. I'm pleased to welcome to the first time my guest this week, Soundgarden frontman Chris Cornell. And I started by asking Chris, as I do with all my guests on the first time, when was the first time he was aware of music?
First song I remember ever hearing was at nap time. I would have had to have been 3 or younger. And it was the song, She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain When She Comes. And I remember sitting there thinking, what a stupid song. It just, that line didn't make any sense to me. Like, why have that in a song? What is the importance of that? And who cares? And who is she? And what difference does it make? And if there's a mountain, I suppose that's how she's going to come, right? You know, she goes over the top.
She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes. She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes. She'll be coming round the mountain. She'll be coming round the mountain. She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes.
And then after that, I had older brothers. So there was the Monkees. There were some Monkees records lying around the house. That kind of, I think, caught my ear. I was probably 4 or 5 or something like that when I heard Monkees albums. And then somewhere in there, by the time I was 8, I think, I ended up with the entire Beatles catalog. And then that's when I really got into music, where it became important to me, where I became sort of a music geek, where I would sit in my bedroom as an activity and just listen to records alone for hours and hours. And I think that period, which lasted a couple of years, where it was just Beatles, I think was sort of like music college in a way for me, or like maybe even not just writing, but recording, singing, record producing, everything without realizing it, because I listened to all of it so much and so intently. And it just seemed to get in there somehow, subconsciously, because I wasn't thinking about it. And I didn't think I would ever be a musician or write songs or be a singer.
What was the Beatles track that maybe blew your mind at that age that kind of opened that door a little bit? It's difficult to pick, obviously. But.
Well, there were different stages of it, but the Sgt. Pepper's I really got into, and that, again, was sort of without the knowledge that that was an album of any importance to anyone. And then I remember listening to Abbey Road with headphones. That was the first headphone experience I had. And, you know, you plug headphones into and turn it up really loud, and it was an amazing experience.
Got to
What about the first records that you owned kind of when you were a teenager, when you were kind of able to pick and choose your own music? What were your first obsessions around then?
I'm not really sure. I think I somehow inherited records more often than I ever was in a position to buy them, because I had older brothers, you know, so I don't remember that being a big moment for me.
So it was just a musical household generally?
It definitely was a reigning record album. Whatever I was into, I could listen to and find. And, the funny thing is that the music that I wasn't necessarily so much into was like Led Zeppelin, for example, which was a band that Soundgarden has been compared to since we were first recording.
So you didn't like
it? I didn't want to hear it. It wasn't that I didn't like it. It was that it was on the radio all the time, and it was also music that would sort of come out of the car windows of, like, Camaros driven by guys that wanted to beat me up, you know? So it was something that I just wasn't interested in culturally, and it didn't make sense to me. Like, I wanted to discover something that I couldn't easily find somewhere else.
Because you did a Led Zeppelin cover. You did a beautiful
cover. Oh, I ended up being a huge Led Zeppelin fan. I mean, they're probably my second favorite band to the Beatles now. But at the time, somehow it just wasn't something that I wanted to get into. And I think it was more of a cultural thing than anything. In America, it was the people I didn't like liked it. And that was true with a lot of bands. You know, I didn't like Aerosmith for the same reason. I didn't like even the Rolling Stones. I didn't like for that reason.
What Led Zepp track should we play, though?
Soundgarden used to do Communication Breakdown, so you could play that. We used to do a kind of a fun version of that.
You're listening to The First Time on Six Music with me, Matt Everett, and my interviewee this week, Mr. Chris Cornell from Soundgarden. And one of the questions I asked Chris was about the very first Soundgarden gigs and what they were like.
I don't remember.
Really?
No. there were two different periods. The first one, I was the drummer and sang from behind the drums. And that was the first year of us playing shows. We became very popular in the Seattle underground scene right away, like right after the very first show.
Wow.
So it was just really exciting, and because it was all original music, and we were sort of quirky. We didn't start out being necessarily a heavy band. We had riffs and we had odd time signatures right away, but we were kind of quirky, and it was very post-punk indie. So there was that, and then we started writing songs that were more aggressive. Some were really fast, some were starting to become heavier, and I just felt like I had to either play the drums or sing. I had to choose one because I wasn't doing either one as good as I thought I should be doing, you know, for this band that was so important to me. Mm. And weirdly, at that time, which was 1985 or something, we couldn't find a singer. Like, I was totally open to the idea of playing drums. I loved it. Couldn't find a singer. And that's unusual to me because it seemed to be like by 1990, there were all these incredible singers everywhere, like more than any other city in the U.S. that I could think of. But at that time, we couldn't find anyone. So
okay,
I ended up being
I'll
the singer.
It. Yeah.
Okay. It was kind of that. It wasn't necessarily my preference. And so then that second period is when I became like a lead singer, wasn't playing guitar, and I didn't really know what to do or how to do it. And I think I dealt with that, just the crazy anxiety of being up in front of people, by just going berserk, kind of, and screaming a lot. The first show we ever played where I was just a lead singer, I had a fever of like 103. I somehow got sick, so I was sort of delirious, and I don't remember much of it, but I spent a lot of time sort of crawling around on the stage and jumping on people, and very little just standing and singing normally.
Bad Motorfinger, 1991, that was kind of the first record to really enjoy success internationally.
Mm-hmm.
Can you remember what it was like when it came out? Because there's that weird jump for bands sometimes when you want something, you're chasing something, and all of a sudden you get what you want, you get that recognition.
Well, I think there's maybe something you expect to happen that doesn't.
What do you mean?
Well, I remember Mike Borden from Faith No More mentioning it one time, how, you know, it means less than you think it will, kind of, I guess. It doesn't change your songs. It doesn't change the sound of your records. It doesn't change who you are or how you perform in them or anything like that. What it does do is there's always this looming threat, I think, in the music business, or maybe in any industry, but definitely the way the music business was structured, in that we came from indie band to becoming like the first Seattle band to sign with a major label. Mm-hmm. And that was okay, provided that at some point you have to start selling records, otherwise someone's going to tell you one day what to do. And we had never had that. We were very independent and knew who we were. We had developed our own audience as an indie band, so you know, no one was really trying to tell us what to do. But to me, that was the main factor. Nothing else really changed. All we did was write songs, record, and tour. You know, even when we had kind of we'd pooled all of our money into one bank account, and we had an accountant one time saying, you know, you can start paying yourselves money because this is adding up. And we didn't really need money for anything, because all we ever did was, we were just in a van, we were on the road, you know. So the biggest change was that feeling like that threat is gone. No one's going to come in and say one day, look, you guys need to consider doing X because you have to sell records, or, you know, or you're not allowed to make records anymore, that kind of thing.
I'm looking.
Black Sabbath thing. Everyone name checks them as a big Soundgarden influence. Mm-hmm. Were you always a big fan of the Sabbath?
Yeah, I think Black Sabbath actually rescued me from like being a Kiss fan. I bought Black Sabbath Paranoid at a time when I think I'd bought a ZZ Top record and Paranoid at the same time. And ZZ Top kind of rescued me from like anything else that was country rock. And Black Sabbath rescued me from any kind of rock that wasn't going to be that dark. And I wore that album out. And I must have been maybe 14 years old. And it had to have had a big impact on me. Just in terms of when I think of particularly Soundgarden, and I think of how comfortable we seem to be with darker, moodier themes, that's got to have roots in listening to Black Sabbath. I mean, I know Kim talks about it too, in the same way.
What track should we play?
Into the Void, one of my favorite songs.
Lucy, you'll see the land and sea. Music.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett, this is Six Music and you're listening to The First Time, the show where we meet some of the most influential figures in music and look at the key moments that changed their musical lives. My guest this week is Soundgarden singer Chris Cornell, and that was Spoon Man from Soundgarden's first number one album, 1994 Super Unknown, an album that also contained their first hit single, the brilliant Black Hole Sun. Yeah. I've got to ask you about Black Hole Sun. 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have that moment when you finished it and thought, okay, this is going to be a bit different?
Yeah, well, MTV did the Fame thing, and I remember the first day that MTV started playing, it was Outshined, I think, and we were somewhere in the US, like in a small town, and I went into a 24-hour grocery store. It was 4 a.m. and there was the butcher, who was probably 45, and he recognized me at 4 a.m. after the first day, and I thought, okay, this is going to change everything. Black Hole Sun, I remember finishing the demo and being really happy with the song and how it turned out. You know, it was very, I wrote most of it in my head, and it wasn't an arduous process arranging it. It was, you know, as it kind of ended up being, really not that much different. And at that time, that wasn't the case for a lot of stuff. I wasn't sure that the band would like it or that it was appropriate for a Soundgarden album.
Really?
And everybody liked it right away. We all wanted it to be on the album, but it wasn't any of us that thought it would be a single. I actually lyrically didn't think that it would be anything that would be popular. Like the, I guess I kind of understand the repetitive chorus and just kind of the moodiness of it, but lyrically it's pretty dark,
you know? Yeah, just
and,
a bit.
You know, to think that it was going to be sort of an international hit was strange, but I have to, you know, I guess we have to feel lucky that it was this song like that that was so moody and dark, you know, and it didn't paint us into a corner. We've been able to do whatever we want since then, and I've been able to do, you know, kind of whatever I want.
In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises no one knows. Has the face, lies the snake. In the sun, in my disgrace, boiling heat, summer stench, neath the
When did you first realise that kind of Soundgarden was maybe you'd gone as far as you could go with that band?
Well, I don't think I ever felt that. I felt like, I guess a little bit paranoid.
Because there's all these rumours of, well, rumours and reports of substance abuse at the time, and the whole thing seemed like quite a heavy
Yeah, I don't think that was really the defining what was happening. I think maybe that was part of it. But to me, what was defining what was happening was just kind of an overall sense of dis-ease about being Soundgarden and the business of it, and just sort of the extraneous factors and the fact that we weren't really communicating like we had as an indie band and as a band that had started where we made all of our decisions and conducted all of our business ourselves. You know, it just became sort of a monster that took on its own life. And it wasn't how we started out.
I have to ask about Audioslave.
Mm-hmm.
That first record, I mean, that is a hell of a lineup. That's you and Tom and Tim and Brad from Rage Against the Machine and Rick Rubin on production duties.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big record.
I had a lot of confidence in that album and in that situation. I just felt like, you know, it was only going to be as pressure filled as we sort of allowed it to seem to us, kind of mentally, like, because we just showed up in a room probably the size of this, which, since no one can see it, it's not very big, and we started writing songs, and we just seemed to click. It was easy, it was fun. I felt confident that it would be great. I was kind of thinking back to Temple of the Dog, where I wasn't sure if some combination other than me and the guys in Soundgarden could create something good.
Yeah.
And then Temple of the Dog happened, and that actually was an indication that, no, there are other collaborations that can be great. And that was a big part of why I thought it would be a good idea to write songs with those guys, and it was. And I think we made three great records. I had a great time doing it, and, you know, it was a great experience for me.
We'll be right back.
That's the Gargantuan Cachisse by Audioslave, a supergroup formed by Chris Cornell from Soundgarden and three quarters of Rage Against the Machine. And you're listening to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week from Soundgarden and Audioslave, Mr. Chris Cornell. You mentioned Temple of the Dog. In 1991, there's the record you did with the band that would become Pearl Jam.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously a band close to your heart. What is it about them?
I think it was a personal friendship first.
Right.
And for me, I think it probably started with Jeff Ament mostly, and surrounding the death of our friend, his and Stone Gossard's bandmate, and my roommate, and one of our best friends, and also someone that inspired us musically and as a person, Andy Wood. When he died at whatever age he was, like 23 or 24, that had a huge impact on us. And I think, you know, we'd all appreciated each other as musicians, but then we became closer as people. That's what drew us together, I think, to make Temple of the Dog. And then once we were in a room playing music, you know, then it was the first time I'd ever met Mike McCready or heard him play or knew anything about him. It was a different situation than for any of us, you know. There were no expectations for the band, for the album, for any of it. It was just, I felt like A&M Records was just sort of doing me a favor to even put it out. Like they felt they had to. And it was really cheaply made and quickly made.
People love that record. People really, really love that record.
Yeah, it felt like, you know, from the very beginning of it, that it just was something that was cathartic and fun and relaxed. You know, the music, it felt inspired, but, you know, there was some other magical quality, like we felt that maybe our friend was looking down on us from a cloud or something, appreciating what we were doing. And what was really happening was we were discovering that there was some version of a healthy way of dealing with an awful tragedy, you know, one that you can't really find a silver lining to, because there isn't one. But we sort of stumbled across a great way of dealing with it.
Cup's already overfilled. Yeah. But it's on the table, the fire's cooking, and the farming babies with slaves are working. The blood is on the table, and the mouths are choking. Decadence.
like to know what it's like when you first go into the studio and you're doing a vocal take for a Bond theme, because do I channel Shirley Bassey? I'm a Tom Jones. What am I supposed to be doing here?
Yeah.
You know.
I was sure about the song. I wrote it with Dave Arnold, and Dave and I, we recorded it and produced it, so it was just us. He was pretty confident about the sound. So I just decided to trust him.
Is this the start of more Soundgarden albums? Is there, like, can you see the road ahead, or are you just taking it very much on a kind of like, this is fun, we're enjoying it, let's keep going?
Well, it's fun, we're enjoying it, and I think it was such a great experience. You know, I can't imagine us not going back and trying it again. Having the four songwriters also, it makes it a little less daunting than, like, doing solo records, for example, because each guy brings in one idea, and you're four songs into it. I already feel like I've got a lot on my plate with four songs, trying to write lyrics and, you know, arranging, and so it doesn't feel to me like we need to stop.
And the final question that we ask everybody is, what's the last song that we should play?
I think maybe Blood on the Valley Floor.
Why that song?
It was the last song I sang on this album, and the last song I wrote lyrics to. It finished it for me, like I knew what the album was when I sent that final take to everyone to hear and decide if they liked it or not, and everyone loved it, and we were kind of done. We were in the middle of mixing, and then I knew what the album was. So it's been special to me ever since.
It's good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
That episode of The First Time was recorded in 2013. Chris Cornell died in 2017. If you enjoyed the show, you might be interested to know that right now on the BBC Sounds app, there's a First Time podcast. And if you subscribe, you can listen to other First Time shows featuring Tom York, Florence and the Machine, Elton John, Dave Grohl, and many, many more. I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Hello, this is a shorter version of a weekly new music playlist titled Handpicked by 6 Music, one of a big collection of music playlists you can now download and subscribe to in the BBC Sounds app. To find the full version, just search Handpicked and check out some of the other playlists tailored for whatever music you need or mood you're in.
I was dancing when I was 12. I was dancing when I was 12. I was dancing when I was up. I was dancing when I was up.